A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about scratching and itching in babies around the one-year mark, especially when transient eczema is in the mix. How do you tell what's normal versus what's worth flagging for the pediatrician? Are there particular spots that are just commonplace scratch zones? And is distress level a reliable signal for when to actually worry?
This is right in the wheelhouse of what I used to see constantly, and the short answer is that parents almost always over-index on the scratching itself and under-index on a few subtler things that matter more. But let me start with the eczema piece, because that's the framing that changes everything.
Because at 1 year, it's basically the Wild West of skin.
Around 12 months, you're in this transitional window where infantile eczema patterns start shifting toward childhood patterns. The distribution changes. In infants, eczema loves the cheeks, the scalp, the extensor surfaces, so the outsides of the arms and legs. By 1 year, you start seeing it migrate to the flexural areas, the insides of the elbows, behind the knees, the wrists, the ankles. If you're seeing a baby who suddenly has rough patches in those folds, that's classic evolving atopic dermatitis, not just random dry skin.
The location itself is already telling you something.
It's one of the first clues. The American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Dermatology both emphasize the distribution pattern as a diagnostic feature. And here's the thing about transient eczema. The term gets thrown around loosely, but what most people mean is that the skin barrier in infants is still maturing. Filaggrin, which is a protein critical for skin barrier function, is often genetically reduced in kids who go on to have persistent eczema. But in the transient cases, the barrier just needs time. The question is whether it's a developmental lag or a chronic condition announcing itself.
How do you actually tell the difference in the moment? Because you can't exactly run a filaggrin assay in the living room.
You can't, but you can look at three things. One, family history. Is there atopic disease in the family? Asthma, allergic rhinitis, eczema? Two, chronicity. Has this patch been there for weeks despite moisturizing, or does it come and go? Three, the skin itself. Transient dryness tends to be more diffuse and responds quickly to emollients. Atopic dermatitis has a different texture. It's more lichenified, meaning the skin thickens from chronic rubbing, and the borders are often more well-defined.
That's a word that sounds like something you'd find on a forest floor.
It's actually a good image, because lichen on a rock has that thickened, leathery look. That's what chronic eczema skin looks like. And once you've seen it, you don't unsee it. But for a parent at home who hasn't seen 100 cases, the thing to watch for is whether the skin in the rough patch looks different from the surrounding skin in a persistent way, not just red, but texturally different.
Okay, so that's the eczema framing. But the prompt also asks about scratching specifically, where babies tend to scratch, and whether the distress level is a useful signal. Let's start with location.
There are genuinely commonplace scratch zones that mean almost nothing. The ears are a big one. Babies around 1 year will grab and tug at their ears constantly, teething, discovering they have ears, self-soothing. If there's no drainage, no redness behind the ear, no fever, and the baby's otherwise happy, ear pulling is basically a hobby at this age.
The ears adjust. Might as well pull them.
The scalp is another one. Cradle cap can linger well past the newborn phase, and even without visible flaking, the scalp can be slightly itchy as the oil glands regulate. A baby scratching the back of their head while falling asleep is practically a developmental milestone. The nose and face in general, exploration, teething drool causing slight irritation, just having a face. None of this is inherently concerning.
What about the places that should make you pay attention?
Persistent scratching of the wrists and ankles. Those are classic atopic sites, and because they're flexural, the skin gets macerated from sweat and friction. If a one-year-old is going after their wrist repeatedly, especially at night, that's worth a closer look. The antecubital fossa, the inside of the elbow, and the popliteal fossa behind the knee. Those are the hallmark locations for evolving eczema, and scratching there tends to be more intense and more focused than the generalized swatting you see with dry skin.
You've been waiting to say that all day.
I've been waiting to say it for 30 years. It's a beautiful phrase, but seriously, the diaper area is another one that gets confusing. Diaper rash is common, but if you're seeing eczema in the diaper area that's not responding to standard barrier creams, that can actually point toward a more systemic atopic picture, or sometimes a secondary yeast infection that needs different treatment.
The prompt specifically asks about the distress signal. If the baby seems unbothered, does that mean you can relax?
This is where I think a lot of the standard advice is actually misleading. The presence of distress is useful, but the absence of distress is not as reassuring as people think. Here's what I mean. If a baby is scratching to the point of breaking skin and seems acutely miserable, crying, can't settle, scratching is interrupting sleep. That's an obvious flag. You're calling the pediatrician. But a lot of one-year-olds with mild to moderate eczema don't seem particularly bothered during the day. They scratch absent-mindedly. They're distracted by everything. The problem is that nighttime scratching is a different animal.
Because they're not distracted.
And because the body's natural cortisol levels drop at night, which reduces the anti-inflammatory response. So you can have a baby who seems fine all day but is quietly scratching in their sleep, and over weeks you start seeing excoriations, scratch marks, that don't heal well. That's a sign of a chronic process that needs management even though the baby isn't wailing about it. The National Eczema Association has good data on this. Sleep disruption is one of the most underreported symptoms in pediatric eczema because parents don't always connect nighttime fussiness to skin discomfort. They think it's teething or a sleep regression or just a phase.
Distress is a sufficient but not necessary condition for flagging it.
That's a very clean way to put it. Distress means flag it. No distress doesn't mean don't flag it. You have to look at the skin itself and the pattern. And I'd add one more thing. Scratching that's localized and persistent but low intensity can still cause problems. The skin barrier gets compromised, you get microabrasions, and that opens the door to secondary infections. Staph aureus colonization is extremely common on eczematous skin, and once you get impetiginized eczema, basically eczema that's become infected, you're in a different treatment category entirely.
Another forest floor word.
It means honey-colored crusting, which is the hallmark of impetigo. If you see that on top of an eczema patch, that's not a wait-and-see situation. That needs antibiotics, usually topical, but sometimes oral.
Let's get practical. A parent has a one-year-old who's scratching. What's the actual decision tree? What do you look at in what order?
First, look at where. Face, scalp, ears with no skin changes, probably normal. Wrists, ankles, elbow creases behind the knees with visible skin changes, probably eczema spectrum. Next, look at the skin itself. Is it just dry and maybe a little pink, or is there texture change? Roughness, thickening, fine scaling? Dry skin is dry skin. Eczematous skin has a different quality. It feels like fine sandpaper, and it doesn't just feel dry, it feels infiltrated, like there's something in the skin.
Infiltrated is a weird word for a tactile sensation.
It's the word dermatologists use. It means the skin feels thicker and denser than it should because of inflammatory cells in the dermis. But for a parent, the practical test is, does this patch feel different from the surrounding skin in a way that doesn't go away after a good moisturizer? If you put on a thick emollient, and I mean thick, something like a petrolatum-based ointment, and 2 hours later the patch feels exactly the same, that's not just dryness.
What about the timing? Is there a seasonal pattern worth knowing?
Winter is worse for almost everyone because of dry indoor air and the constant cycle of cold outside, heated inside. But here's a less obvious one. Summer can be a trigger too, specifically because of sweat. Sweat contains trace amounts of minerals and compounds that can be irritating to a compromised skin barrier, and chlorine from swimming pools. So, you'll sometimes see a pattern where the skin improves in late spring, then flares in July and August when the baby is sweating more.
The seasons can give you a false sense of resolution. It clears up in April, you think you're done, then July hits.
Then you wonder if it's a new thing when it's actually the same thing responding to a different trigger. That's why dermatologists talk about eczema as a chronic condition with intermittent flares rather than something that comes and goes. The underlying predisposition doesn't go away. The expression of it fluctuates.
The prompt also mentions that transient eczema is common around this age. Is there a typical arc? Does it usually resolve, or is the one-year mark a fork in the road?
The data on this is actually pretty robust. About 60% of kids who have eczema in infancy will outgrow it by adolescence. But the one-year mark is interesting because it's around the time when you start to see which kids are on which trajectory. The kids who are going to outgrow it tend to have milder cases that respond well to basic moisturizing and maybe intermittent low-potency topical steroids. The kids who are going to have persistent eczema tend to have more widespread involvement, earlier onset, like before 6 months, and a stronger family history.
The one-year mark isn't a fork so much as a slow reveal of which path you're already on.
And the reason it matters is that early, consistent treatment can actually change the trajectory. There's been a shift in thinking over the past decade or so. It used to be that pediatricians would recommend treating flares reactively. Now the approach, especially for major centers like the Mayo Clinic and the American Academy of Dermatology, is more about proactive maintenance. Once you get the skin clear, you keep treating the previously affected areas with a lower frequency, like twice a week, even when they look fine. That's called proactive therapy, and the evidence shows it reduces flares and may help prevent the so-called atopic march.
The atopic march? That sounds ominous.
It's the observed progression where eczema in infancy is followed by food allergies, then allergic rhinitis, then asthma. Not every kid follows that path, but there's a statistical pattern. The theory is that a disrupted skin barrier allows allergens to enter through the skin rather than through the gut, which primes the immune system differently and predisposes to allergic sensitization. So treating eczema aggressively early on isn't just about comfort. It might actually reduce the risk of developing other atopic conditions down the line.
That's a much bigger deal than just managing some dry skin.
And it's one of those things where the science has really solidified in the last 10 to 15 years. The LEAP study and others have shifted how we think about early allergen exposure, but the skin barrier piece is equally important. If you can keep the barrier intact, you may be preventing sensitization to things like peanut and egg that enter through microscopic cracks in the skin.
The stakes are higher than just, is my baby uncomfortable?
And that's why I always told parents in my practice, don't feel like you're being dramatic by bringing up a rash. The worst that happens is the pediatrician says it's nothing and you get peace of mind. The best that happens is you catch something early that benefits from early intervention.
Let me circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the nighttime scratching. How does a parent even monitor that if they're asleep?
A few things to look for. 1. Blood spots on the sheets, tiny ones from excoriations. 2. The baby waking more frequently than usual without an obvious cause. 3. And this is a good one, the state of the baby's nails. If you're finding skin debris under the nails in the morning, that's evidence of nighttime scratching. Some parents put cotton mittens or onesies with built-in hand covers on their babies at night, and if those are getting worn through or the baby is fighting them off, that tells you something.
Skin debris under the nails. That's both useful and mildly horrifying.
Parenthood is basically a series of mildly horrifying but diagnostically useful observations.
What about the scalp specifically? You said it's common, but at what point does scalp scratching cross the line into something worth checking?
If it's associated with visible scaling that's yellow and greasy, that's seborrheic dermatitis, cradle cap, and it's benign even if it looks dramatic. If it's dry, fine, white scaling with redness, and the baby is really going at it, that could be atopic dermatitis of the scalp. And if there are well-defined patches of hair loss with scaling, you need to think about tinacapidus, ringworm of the scalp, which is fungal and needs oral antifungals. That one's less common but easy to miss because people assume it's just cradle cap that won't quit.
If there's hair loss, that's a clear flag.
And tinacapidus can cause permanent hair loss if untreated, so it's not a cosmetic concern. It's a treatable infection that has consequences if ignored.
You mentioned earlier that the diaper area can be confusing. Unpack that a bit.
The diaper area is a high humidity, high friction environment. It's uniquely prone to irritant contact dermatitis from urine and stool, and also to candidal infections, yeast, which thrive in warm, moist areas. Eczema in the diaper area is actually less common than in other areas because the moisture paradoxically protects the skin barrier to some degree. But when you do see it, it tends to spare the inguinal folds, the creases. Whereas irritant diaper dermatitis and candidiasis tend to involve the folds. So if you see a red, rough rash that's mostly on the convex surfaces, the buttocks, the thighs, and the creases, look relatively clear, think eczema. If the creases are red and angry, think yeast or irritation.
That's a useful heuristic. Convex versus crease.
It's not 100%, but it's directionally very reliable. And candidal rashes have a characteristic look. They're bright red with little satellite lesions, small red dots outside the main border of the rash. If you see satellites, it's yeast.
We've covered location, skin texture, distress, nighttime patterns, seasonal patterns, the atopic march, and the diaper area. What about treatment? The prompt didn't ask for a full treatment guide. But if a parent is trying to decide whether to call the pediatrician, part of that decision is whether they've already tried the obvious things.
And the obvious things are not always obvious. So here's the baseline that I would consider the threshold for. I've tried what I can at home. Number one, you're using a fragrance-free, thick emollient, not a lotion, which is mostly water, but a cream or ointment, at least twice a day, including immediately after bathing while the skin is still damp. Number two, you're doing short, lukewarm baths, not hot, not long, 10 minutes max, and you're patting dry, not rubbing. Number three, you've eliminated obvious irritants. Fragranced laundry detergent, fabric softener, wool clothing directly against the skin. If you've done all that for a week or two and the skin isn't improving, or if it's getting worse, that's your cue to call.
A week or two feels like a long time when you're watching your baby scratch.
And I'd modify that. If the scratching is intense, if skin is broken, if there's any sign of infection like honey-colored crusting or oozing, don't wait. The 1 to 2 week window is for mild, non-disruptive dryness. Anything beyond that, shorten the timeline.
What about over-the-counter hydrocortisone? Is that something parents should try before calling, or is that a call-first situation?
For a one-year-old, I'd say call first. 1% hydrocortisone is available over-the-counter, and it's relatively safe for short-term use, but the skin of a one-year-old is thinner and more absorbent than adult skin, and the face and diaper area absorb even more. You don't want to be using even a mild topical steroid on the face or in the diaper area without guidance because those areas are more prone to side effects like skin thinning and telangiectasias, little visible blood vessels. So my general rule, body maybe, face, diaper area, or widespread, get guidance.
This episode is a goldmine of words I will never pronounce correctly.
It's a great word. But the point is, steroids are not benign just because they're over the counter. They're real medications with real side effect profiles, and infants are not just small adults. Their body surface area to weight ratio is much higher, which means topical medications have a proportionally larger systemic effect.
That's one of those things that seems obvious once you say it, but most people wouldn't think of it.
It's why pediatric dermatology exists as a subspecialty. Kids are pharmacokinetically different. And a one-year-old is at a particularly tricky stage because they're mobile, they're touching everything, they're putting their hands in their mouth, so whatever you put on their skin is going to end up in their mouth at some point.
Let's talk about the psychological dimension for a moment. The prompt mentions distress as a possible signal. But there's also the parental distress, which is real and valid even if the baby seems fine. Watching your kid scratch constantly is unsettling in a way that's hard to articulate.
It's viscerally uncomfortable. And I think parents sometimes downplay it to themselves because they don't want to be the person who calls the pediatrician over a rash. But here's the thing I used to tell parents in my practice. Your discomfort matters too. Not because the pediatrician needs to treat your anxiety, but because parental observation is a legitimate diagnostic tool. If something feels off to you, there's a decent chance something is off, even if you can't articulate exactly what. The parent who says, "I don't know," he just seems uncomfortable in his own skin. That's actually a useful clinical observation.
Uncomfortable in his own skin is both a metaphor and a literal description in this case.
And the one-year mark is a particularly hard age to assess discomfort because the baby can't tell you what's wrong. They're pre-verbal or just starting to have a few words. So you're reading body language, sleep patterns, feeding behavior, general fussiness, all of which are nonspecific. That's why the skin exam is so important. It's one of the few objective things you can actually see and track.
You mentioned earlier that about 60% of infant eczema cases resolve by adolescents. What about the 40% who don't? What does that path look like?
Those kids tend to have more persistent, more severe disease. They often have a strong family history of atopy. They may have already developed food allergies or allergic rhinitis by school age. Their eczema tends to be more treatment resistant. They need stronger topical steroids, or they need non-steroid topicals like calcineurin inhibitors, or in severe cases, systemic medications like dupilumab, which is now approved for children as young as 6 months. The good news is that the treatment landscape has transformed in the last decade. We have options now that simply didn't exist when I started practicing.
Dupilumab for a 6-month-old sounds intense.
It's a biologic injection, and it's reserved for severe refractory cases. But the fact that it's approved at all tells you how serious severe eczema can be. These are kids who were sleeping 2 hours a night, whose skin was cracked and bleeding, who were getting recurrent skin infections. For those families, dupilumab is life-changing. But it's not the first, second, or third line of treatment. It's what you reach for when everything else has failed.
For the parent of a 1-year-old who's just starting to notice some scratching and dry patches, that's not even on the radar.
Not even close. The vast majority of these kids will be managed perfectly well with emollients, trigger avoidance, and maybe intermittent low-potency topical steroids. But it's helpful to know the full spectrum because it puts the mild cases in perspective. If your baby has a couple of rough patches on their elbows that respond to moisturizer, you're in a very different universe from the family dealing with severe atopic dermatitis. And knowing that can actually be reassuring.
Perspective as treatment for parental anxiety.
The internet will show you the worst-case scenario for everything. Your job is to figure out where on the spectrum your kid actually is, and the answer is usually closer to the benign end.
Let me ask about something the prompt hinted at, but didn't spell out. The difference between scratching as a symptom and scratching as a behavior. Because at 1 year, babies are also discovering cause and effect. They scratch. It feels interesting. They do it more. How do you distinguish behavioral scratching from pathological scratching?
This is a really astute question. Behavioral scratching tends to be more exploratory and less focused. The baby scratches their arm, then their leg, then their head. It's diffuse, it's intermittent, and it doesn't have the driven quality of pruritic scratching. Pathological scratching is more targeted. The baby goes back to the same spot over and over. They may scratch in their sleep, which is not behavioral, and you'll see skin changes in the areas they're targeting. If the skin looks completely normal and the baby is just kind of swatting at themselves occasionally, that's probably behavioral. If there's a visible rash or the scratching is intense and focused, that's probably pruritus.
Pruritus being the medical term for itching.
And pruritus in eczema is not just a mild sensation. It's often described as a burning, stinging itch that's disproportionate to what you see on the skin. That's one of the hallmarks of atopic dermatitis. The itch is out of proportion to the visible rash, which is why distress can be a useful signal. But as we discussed, its absence doesn't rule out pathology.
You've mentioned the American Academy of Pediatrics and the National Eczema Association. Are there particular resources you'd point parents toward if they're in that not sure whether to call zone?
The AAP's Healthy Children website has a very good, straightforward eczema section that covers the basics without being alarmist. The National Eczema Association has more detailed resources, including a symptom tracker that can be useful for figuring out triggers. And I always appreciated the Mayo Clinic's patient education materials. They're clear, they're evidence-based, and they don't talk down to you.
The symptom tracker is interesting. What does tracking actually look like for a 1-year-old?
Note the location of any rash or scratching. Note what the skin looks like, red, dry, bumpy, scaly. Note any potential triggers from that day, new foods, new soaps, outdoor time, illness, teething. Note sleep quality. Over 2 or 3 weeks, patterns often emerge that aren't visible day to day. Maybe the rash flares every time they have eggs. Maybe it's worse on bath nights. Maybe it correlates with days they spend at the park. You're essentially doing a single subject study, and the data is more powerful than you'd think.
Single subject study. That's a very Homan way to describe parenting.
Parenting is applied science with a sample size of 1, or 2, or 3, depending on how many kids you have.
I want to go back to something you said about the atopic march, the progression from eczema to food allergies to asthma. Is that progression something that happens regardless of treatment, or does good eczema management actually interrupt it?
The evidence is still evolving, but the direction is promising. The hypothesis is that a disrupted skin barrier is the entry point for allergens, and that early and consistent barrier protection may reduce the risk of allergic sensitization. There was a landmark trial in Japan a few years back that looked at newborns at high risk for atopic dermatitis. They started aggressive moisturizing from birth, and the intervention group had a significantly lower rate of eczema at 32 weeks. The question is whether that translates to lower rates of food allergy and asthma down the line. The follow-up data is still coming in, but the biological plausibility is strong.
The moisturizer might be doing more than just soothing dry skin. It might be preventing a cascade.
That's the hope, and it reframes the whole conversation. Moisturizing isn't just cosmetic or comfort care, it's potentially disease-modifying. That doesn't mean every baby needs to be slathered in ointment from day one, but for babies with a family history of atopy, it's a low-risk, low-cost intervention with potentially significant upside.
That's the kind of thing that should be more widely known.
It's getting there. The guidelines are shifting. The American Academy of Dermatology now includes proactive maintenance as a standard recommendation for atopic dermatitis. But there's a lag between guideline changes and what actually happens in primary care. Pediatricians are generalists. They're managing everything from ear infections to developmental screening to vaccine schedules. Keeping up with the latest in eczema management is a lot to ask.
Which brings us back to the parent's role as the frontline observer.
The parent is the one seeing the rash every day, noticing the scratching, tracking the sleep disruption. The pediatrician sees the baby for 15 minutes every few months. The parent's observations are the most important data set in the room.
The prompt's cool question, how do you distinguish normal from worth mentioning, is really about equipping parents to trust their observations and know what to look for.
That's it. And I'd summarize it this way. Normal, occasional, diffuse scratching with no skin changes, or mild dryness that responds to moisturizer. Worth mentioning, persistent scratching focused on specific areas, especially flexural areas like the inner elbows and behind the knees, with visible skin changes that don't resolve with moisturizing. Urgent mention, broken skin, signs of infection like honey-colored crusting or oozing, scratching that's interfering with sleep or causing visible distress, hair loss with scaling, or any rash that's getting worse despite home care.
That's a clean framework.
The distress piece. I want to reiterate this. Distress is a sufficient reason to call, but lack of distress is not a sufficient reason to ignore. The skin tells its own story.
What's the single most common mistake you saw parents make with this stuff?
By a mile. People use a pea-sized amount of lotion when they should be using a golf ball-sized amount of thick cream or ointment. The skin of a baby with eczema needs to be basically greasy. If you're not leaving a slight sheen, you're probably not using enough. And the second mistake is stopping treatment the moment the skin looks better. Eczema is a chronic condition. The inflammation is still there even when the visible rash has faded. That's the whole logic behind proactive therapy.
The secret to dermatological health.
Greasy babies with short nails. That's the summary of pediatric eczema management.
This has been clarifying. And I think it's one of those topics where a little bit of structured knowledge goes a long way, because the anxiety lives in the ambiguity.
The ambiguity is the hardest part. If you know what you're looking at and you have a framework for deciding what's normal and what's not, the anxiety drops significantly. You're not wondering if you're overreacting or underreacting. You have criteria.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, a Soviet statistician stationed in the Seychelles discovered that if you flip a coin and listen to the sound it makes when it lands, the specific acoustic ring of metal on tile, you can predict the next flip's outcome with 51% accuracy, a paradox that vanishes the moment you try to explain it mathematically.
A fact that definitely happened.
51% accuracy on coin flips. I have so many questions, and I'm not sure I want any of them answered.
A paradox that vanishes when you explain it is basically the definition of this show.
This has been My Weird Props. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and thanks to everyone listening. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps.
We're back next week. Until then, moisturize generously.
Keep those nails short.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.